Thank you very much, Guy. I'm not using the mic. I'm trying to shout, but if I forget to and become inaudible, people at the back, please wave your hands. Welcome to apparently the second best university in the UK. I always say that the difference between these two great seats of learning is a perfect example of Sigmund Freud's thesis of the narcissism of minor difference. And I enjoyed very much coming to meet you, or many of you, at King's College, Cambridge last year, and it's very nice to see you at Queen's College, Oxford, this year. And especially that so many of you have come here from different parts of Europe at a time when, as Brian hinted, Britain can hardly be the destination of choice. Perhaps you were hoping to get a first glimpse of what life outside Europe might look like. If so, I'm afraid we've managed to disappoint you, even in that. Britain seems more and more like the guests in Buñuel's film, The Exterminating Angel, recently turned into an opera by the great British composer Thomas Addis. They keep saying that it's time to leave, but some invisible force holds them back. Hour after hour, night after night, they stay on, bickering among themselves and an embarrassment to their hosts. How did we get into this state? It's a question we keep asking ourselves, but perhaps we're not the best people to answer it. In fact, the clearest and most convincing explanation I have seen is to be found written in a book, perhaps not surprisingly, by an Irishman, Kevin O'Rourke, a colleague of mine at the college next door. The book is called A Short History of Brexit, From Brentry to the Backstop, and it was first published in French last year, but has now appeared in English as well. Kevin is an economic historian. His book explains with wonderful clarity such things as the difference between a free trade area, a customs union, and a single market. He shows how, in the 40s and 50s, Britain ducked and weaved to prevent other European countries from integrating economically, and how Harold Macmillan, a Conservative Prime Minister, concluded in the end that we had no option but to join them. He also shows that Ireland joining the European community at the same time as Britain was anything but a coincidence, and that it was quite inevitable that once Britain decided to leave, the Irish border would become the main sticking point. Yet, that issue was almost entirely ignored in the referendum campaign, and even now, many British politicians regard the EU's insistence on maintaining the economic unity of Ireland as perverse and malicious, failing to understand that the very logic of the European Union requires it to stick up for one of its members in a dispute with outsiders or those who have decided to become outsiders. So it's a fitting irony that the hottest property on the London market right now is an Irish passport. Many of us are wondering how on earth our fairy godmothers failed to provide us with the gift that turns out to be the most essential for a happy life, namely an Irish grandparent. In that respect, of course, Kevin is okay. He already has an Irish passport. He has promised a definitive paperback edition of the book in the autumn, fondly imagining, I suppose, that by then the drama will have been resolved one way or other. But this week, he announced that he's moving to Abu Dhabi. Sounds to me rather like a cry of despair. Well, I suppose it serves us right for being so damn pleased with ourselves in previous centuries. And that's why I chose my title, as you heard, from the words of the dying John of Gaunt in Shakespeare's Richard II, "That England that was wont to conquer others hath made a shameful conquest of itself." Enough about Brexit. Brian's request was that I segue from there into a, quote, "a reminder that the values of patience, sincerity, modesty, and tact in public utterance are for all time and will come back into fashion." Certainly, those values seem to be rather lacking in British, or at least English, public life at the moment. Some observers also note something which should be of concern to this gathering: a decline in the quality of political rhetoric. This may have something to do with the background of leading politicians. A generation ago, many of those on the front benches of the House of Commons on both sides of the aisle had the letters QC after their name. It stands for Queen's Counsel and means you have gained eminence, and usually wealth, by arguing cases in the law courts. Nowadays, politicians on the Conservative side are more likely to come from a business background, while the Labour ones have been school teachers or worked in local government. Too many have spent virtually their whole careers in politics. The few who do still come from the legal profession, like Dominic Grieve, the former Attorney General, stand out by their ability to frame an argument in coherent and well-constructed sentences. But, as you all know better than me, in today's world of sound bites and social media, that counts for little. Anyway, this decline in civility is by no means confined to Britain. Sadly, it is a feature of the international scene. In so many parts of the world, from the US to China, through Brazil, Russia, India, and the Philippines, and indeed in much of Europe, even outside the UK, we see abrasive and xenophobic forms of nationalism gaining ground, often with encouragement from both Vladimir Putin and Steve Bannon. With hindsight, this makes the world of Kofi Annan, for whom I had the honour to write speeches between 1998 and 2006, seem quite benign. Yet it didn't seem so at the time. Kofi came to office at a time when the New World Order envisaged by George Bush Sr. at the end of the Cold War was already being described as a New World Disorder. The demise of the Soviet Union, instead of marking the end of history predicted by Francis Fukuyama, had unleashed bitter ethnic conflicts in Transcaucasia, Central Asia, and, indirectly but of greatest concern to us in Europe, in the Western Balkans. And there was unfinished business with Iraq, which came to dominate our lives and poison the global atmosphere. And there had been genocide in Rwanda in 1994, with a terrible aftermath, unfinished even now, of endemic and seemingly endless conflict in the Congo. Annan came to office with a major albatross around his neck in the shape of the failure of UN peacekeeping forces to prevent that genocide, as well as the smaller but even more obviously preventable one at Srebrenica in Bosnia in 1995. Both these disasters, albeit largely imputable to the unwillingness of troop-contributing countries to take timely action, had happened on his watch as head of UN peacekeeping, and he was never able to live them down. Much of his work as Secretary General, and consequently much of my work as his speechwriter, was devoted to trying to ensure that they could not happen again, by frankly acknowledging the UN's failure in both places, by working to get the Security Council to give peacekeeping forces more robust mandates and the resources to carry them out, and by developing the doctrine which became known as the responsibility to protect. Annan made a very large number of public speeches during his time in office, but he was seldom really comfortable reading a prepared text. I was remember in particular occasion when he was speaking to the World Affairs Conference in Los Angeles at the time when Arnold Schwarzenegger was the governor of California. And so we thought it was a good idea to put a joke at the beginning of the speech, in which he said, well, I really like California, and indeed, I hope I'll be back. unfortunately, Kofi read this as, and I will be back. I expect you've all had those nightmare moments when your principal doesn't quite deliver something in the way that you drafted it. So the most gratifying moments for me were not usually when he delivered lines that I had written, but when phrases from them reappeared in his impromptu discourse. It was his ability to give clear and articulate answers off the cuff, interacting with an audience and showing that he'd fully thought through his arguments, which communicated itself even to people watching him on TV or video thousands of miles away, and made him, in the words of his friend Richard Holbrook, a rock star of diplomacy. So if I heard him using a phrase that I had drafted in impromptu, I knew that that meant he'd really appreciated and internalized it. Though even then it could go delightfully wrong, as when I wrote that new technology could enable developing countries to leapfrog some of the more painful stages that previously industrialized countries had gone through, He liked that thought and repeated it several times, but at least once the word came out as frog leap. In general, I would not say that Kofi Annan had an easy time of it as Secretary General, even if it was, in retrospect, a better time than the one the current holder of that office has to deal with. His second term especially had many painful moments. The terror attacks of September the 11th, 2001 had brought a marked change in the international climate, and his appeal on that day for cool and reasoned judgment went largely unheeded. By choosing to attack Iraq, America squandered the worldwide sympathy the attacks had brought it and found itself on a collision course with the majority of UN member states, including its partners in the Security Council. Kofi tried desperately to bring the UN back together and to demonstrate its usefulness, notably by sending Sergio Vieira de Mello, perhaps the UN's most able administrator, to head a new UN mission in Baghdad, where he and 21 other UN staffers, including some of the organization's best and brightest and several good friends of mine, met their deaths when the headquarters was blown up by a suicide bomber on August the 19th, 2003. The UN's 9/11, some called it. It was especially a severe blow for Kofi, who could not avoid feeling personally responsible and for whom de Mello was a close friend as well as a colleague. Bitter, too, were the attacks that rained down on him from American journalists and politicians who sought to distract attention from the increasingly dire consequences of the invasion by focusing on evidence of corruption in the Oil for Food program, intended to palliate the effects of UN sanctions on Iraqi civilians, which the UN had administered from 1996 to 2003. Those attacks became increasingly personal when it emerged that Annan's son, Kojo, had worked for a Swiss company charged with inspecting the consignments of food and other humanitarian supplies which Iraq was allowed to import. Kojo's own work had nothing to do with Iraq, and there was no evidence that his father had played any part in getting him the job. But Annan's claim not even to have known that the company was competing for the contract was widely disbelieved. Fred Eckhart, his spokesman, and I, as Director of Communications, believed and repeated Kojo's assurances that he had had nothing more to do with the company after leaving it at the end of 1999. And we looked very stupid when it emerged in late 2004 that actually he had continued to receive payments under a non-compete arrangement up to the beginning of that year. With difficulty, we persuaded Kofi to say publicly that he was, quote, surprised and disappointed by his son's conduct. Although he was eventually exonerated by the inquiry chaired by Paul Volcker, former head of the US Federal Reserve, there were many attacks on him in the press and even calls for his resignation from at least one US senator. He survived to serve out his term, but was clearly weakened and more dependent than previously on the support of the US administration. So those were not easy times for the UN or for Kofi Annan personally. Yet, I think Brian is right to say that he exemplified those qualities of patience, sincerity, modesty, and tact in public utterance, which are badly needed and too often missed in the world today. They are indeed what the European Union was supposed to be all about, learning from each other and working together. That was what we did in Kofi's team at the UN, and I'm sure it's what we will do together today. As European speechwriters, Brexit or no Brexit. Thank you very much.